now more than ever, people need to go within and plug into that cellular memory, plug into divine source, detach as much as possible from the matrix. A lot of these people that have all these abilities, who have celestial star ancestry, they're operating not only throughout this cosmos, but in higher planes, and they're working against the Draco Empire. Photonic energy and the cosmic rays will activate our higher centers. And it's incumbent upon us to ride that frequency wave.
Hello again, everybody. This is James Bartley, and you are listening to Bartley's Commentaries on the Cosmic Wars. Today, I want to talk about time and time manipulation from the perspective of an alien abductee, a MyLab, and a shamanistic perspective as well. There's a lot of talk these days about alternate timelines, time travel, time loops. And for those just coming to grips with this, I can understand it could be pretty difficult to wrap one's mind around the concept. So I thought it would be a good idea to talk about what has been reported in the field of UFO literature, firsthand accounts by eyewitnesses to the close approach of alien craft, as well as the accounts of alien abductees in my labs. The alien craft, when they enter into a certain location, sometimes they seem to instill a vacuum stillness. Some of you have heard me talk about this, but not in this time context. A very commonly reported feature in the past was a motorist would see a UFO flying towards them, either daytime or nighttime, and then the motor of the engine would cut out. And the percipient, i.e. the eyewitness, would observe the UFO. Sometimes he or she would notice that there is no background ambient noise. No birds chirping, no crickets chirping or cricketing, whatever sound they make, no cicadas, no insect buzzes, no nothing. It's been described as a vacuum stillness, the area in which the alien craft had moved into has suddenly been plunged into a vacuum stillness. And a commonly reported feature was that the motor of the engine would cut out and the headlights would go out and the car, for all intents and purposes, would be dead. And as soon as the craft left, the motor would kick right back in again. It would kick back in mid-stroke. It wouldn't be a case where the craft departed and then the motorist got back into the car or was still sitting in the car, turned the motor on, and it turned over. No. What I mean is, as soon as the craft left the vicinity, the engine kicked back into high gear as if it never missed a stroke. As if the motor itself in the sequence of combustion engine motors, the intake of the fuel air gas mixture into the chamber, and then the ignition, and then the pistons activating, etc., etc., it was as if it was frozen in time by whatever force was exerted by this craft. And then as soon as the craft left the vicinity, The lights came back on the headlights. The radio came back on. The engine kicked back into life without missing a stroke, without sputtering, without missing a beat. In a recent interview that Bob Lazar gave to George Knapp, Bob Lazar talked about his misgivings about ever having gone public and how the fact that he'd gone public in the past about his involvement as a physicist working at S4, trying to understand the propulsion system and power source for the Zeta Reticulan craft, what he dubbed the sport model. In the interview, he talked about how it was bad for business, basically, how his past had become an embarrassment for him. But in that interview, I can't remember if it was at the 24, 25-minute mark, he talked about the effect that high gravitational waves, high-intensity gravitational waves, had on a candle. Now, for those of you not familiar with Bob Lazar's story, I'll tell you a bit about gravity A and gravity B as Bob Lazar understood it in the S4 project. Gravity A, if memory serves, is gravity A. That's the gravity we're all familiar with that kind of holds the planets and the moons and everything in place. And he points out that this is a rather weak gravity wave because all anyone has to do to momentarily defy it is jump up. And for that moment that they are in air and as they descend back to Earth, they have defeated that gravity. The gravity B that he worked with comes from super heavy elements, super heavy stable elements, such as element 115. And Lazar points out that though it is not a naturally occurring element in our solar system, there are other solar systems that are binary or multiple star systems. And during the creation of these binary and multiple star system solar systems, there would have been far more opportunity for elements to be created that would not be found in a solar system such as ours. And element 15 is one of these, which the Zeta Reticulians seem to have a large amount of. And the element 115 gives off its own gravitational field, gravity B, as dubbed by Bob Lazar and his team. And this gravity wave can be accessed and amplified. What they did was, at the facility at S4, they did an experiment. They took one of the gravity wave amplifiers from beneath one of the alien Zeta Reticulan craft. They brought it to a workbench, and then they got a candle, lit the candle, and then they powered up the gravity wave amplifier, which was connected to the element 115 power source. What happened, according to Bob Lazar, was that the flame was frozen. That's right. When the flame was exposed to the powerful gravitational field emitted by the gravity wave amplifier, the flame froze. It did not emit any heat, and it did not flicker. It did not do anything except remain in place. And Bob Lazar was, quite frankly, perplexed, baffled, confused, because it basically violated every concept of physics that he had come to understand. So what I'm trying to point out here is that by exerting a powerful gravitational field upon a flame, they effectively froze the flame. And I can't remember if he said it no longer gave off heat, or if it did give off heat, that would have been even more perplexing, because the only way the flame could still remain aflame is if it absorbed or basically ate oxygen. But here is this flame frozen, and it just absolutely perplexed Bob Lazar. So the point of relevance is there seemed to have been effect by the gravity wave amplifier emitting the strong gravitational field, which made the flame freeze. And we're talking about time here. We're talking about the locality, how time can be very location specific. There are some that have kind of a linear, logical, reductionist mindset. They have a problem wrapping their mind around time because, well, they overcomplicate things. They say, okay, how could you do time travel? If you go back in time and then everything in the universe at that point in time in the past would have to be essentially, from their viewpoint, recreated. Every cell in your own body, every molecule, every atom, not only on Earth in that particular point in time and space, but throughout the universe. And some of these people think that everything has to be recreated exactly the way it was at a point in the past. But that's overcomplicating things. All that has to be done is change the time, if you will, in a given locale, in a given place. It doesn't have to involve everywhere else. So if one goes back into a different point in space, time on Earth, say the Middle Ages, that doesn't necessarily affect the rest of the universe. Although I must say that time manipulation is going on constantly, because of not only on a major scale, and I hope I'm not sounding like I'm contradicting myself what I just said a moment ago, because I'm going to be talking about some of the dynamics of alien time manipulation on a micro and a macro scale. On a micro scale, on almost a daily or nightly basis, various alien groups are manipulating with time. If an alien abductee suddenly notices that everyone in their home is in a freeze frame mode, and there's a vacuum stillness all around, and bright lights are flooding in through the windows, and even somehow flooding in through the ceiling, and everyone is in freeze frame, and suddenly aliens show up, and then they float him through the ceiling up into a waiting craft and take him away, and then he's returned, he or she is returned later on, but there is no missing time. You often hear about missing time, where a person is physically abducted and they're returned, and then if their memories are wiped, they may have a few hours which they cannot account for. I'm not talking about that. That's a certain way abductions are carried out. What some alien groups do is they can, if they so choose, return somebody, slot them right back in to the moment in time and space. I think the term time continuum is a misnomer. Time continuum suggests a linearity, a linear aspect to time. This is what happens when people think in logical reductionist 3D terms. They come up with terms like the fabric of time, of space-time, the time continuum. Well, I'll use that phrase because it's in such common usage, but some ET groups can slot that person back to the exact moment that they were abducted and then allow time to flow as normal. And everyone starts moving around, the household pets start moving around, the TV turns back on, everything snaps back into place, a timeless, seamless transition. And some ETs have this ability. Also, certain deep black elements of the military also have this ability, where they can take a MyLab and either take them off world or take them off into another dimension or take them into an underground base in our space-time, if you will, train them, manipulate them, mind control them, whatever the case may be, for hours, days, and even weeks, and then certain elements of the military can then return that person back. So only a very, either no amount of time has passed from the standpoint or reference point of not only themselves, but the people in their home. So they return the woman, in our example, right back to where she wakes up in bed with plenty of time to get up and get her children out of bed, ready for school, so on and so forth. Okay, that's an example of how the ETs and the military can, on a daily and nightly basis, manipulate people and manipulate time in a very specific location, which doesn't affect the rest of the so-called time stream. It must be understood. People overcomplicate things. They think if you go back 5 minutes in time, it's got to be a rewind, and everything has to snap back the way it was 5 minutes ago. You see a scene like that in the Doctor Strange movie, which I referenced before in a previous commentary, where everything kind of like rolls backwards, and everyone goes backwards. And you saw this in the first Superman movie with Christopher Reeve, when he makes the world spin in the opposite fashion in order to make everything go back to the way it was. It doesn't necessarily work that way. And the way that some alien races work in a macrocosmic scale is some of these ET races that are trying to extend their biological evolution by engaging in a hybridization process, by utilizing Earth human DNA to revivify their species. Think of some of the Zeta Gray type looking beings, or some of the other gray looking, to use a generic term, a gray looking alien being. Some of those beings, some of those civilizations are heavily involved in the hybridization process. What some of them have done in order to give themselves, quote, more time, is to go back and alter the timeline in such a way as to give themselves more time in order to see that this crossbreeding hybridization program of theirs pans out, comes to some successful outcome. Because as Dan Burish and others have pointed out, some of these beings are actually from the future, and they have come back in time to manipulate things, to continue their hybridization program in order to ensure a future for themselves. Dan Sherman was the intuitive communicator working for Air Force Security Service. And in the 1970s, early, mid-1970s, he was tasked with the superiors in Air Force Security Service, which is the National Security Agency Air Force subsidiary, now known as the Air Force Electronic Security Command. Dan Sherman was told by his superiors in the Air Force that there will come a point in time when the electric grid will go down, communications will go down, basically the world will be plunged into darkness. But they will still have to maintain combo with at least one particular ET race, or at least the ET race that that particular sub-project was interacting with. Because there's more than one ET race that, in truth, factions of the deep black military aerospace exclusively or with particular ET groups. It's not all the same. It's not all one consolidated block. So Dan Sherman was with an Air Force Security Service project working with the Zetas we keep hearing about. Bob Lazar worked on Zeta technology, to give an example. So Dan Sherman was a MILAB for all intents and purposes. He was a legitimate alien abductee. His mother was a legitimate alien abductee. He was genetically enhanced, if you will, by the ETs, probably while he was still in the womb, and made to be able to telepathically, at one point, at some future point in time, telepathically communicate with the Zetas, or this faction of the Zetas anyway. And once he got going with the job, he was receiving telepathic transmissions with two different Zetas. One of them he called Spock because he was very serious. He didn't seem to have any kind of sense of humor. And he had another nickname for the other Zeta that he was in telepathic combo with. Can't remember if he called him Bones or something. Anyway, the one that was more talkative, that wasn't just all business and very straight-laced, which I think Spock was, but the other one that was more talkative, Dan Sherman had unauthorized combo with him. And this other Zeta told him that, yes, they can manipulate time. And the way it was described by this Zeta was that they go around time, right? Read into that what you will. One of the, at the time, well-known MyLabs in the 1990s, Leah Haley, who was a personal friend of mine. I've since lost combo with her. And unfortunately for Leah, and she wouldn't mind me saying this, we were good friends, and I like to think that we still are good friends. I know her story as well as anyone. When she first came out, she talked about contact with several different ET races, including a reptilian, Pleiadians, chalky-colored creatures that looked like gray in outline, but were chalky, not chalky gray, chalky white in color. And at one time, she believe herself to be an alien abductee with MyLab experiences, but due to a long-term, comprehensive, lack of a better term, mind control program that was exerted onto her, she came to believe over time that it was all military and no aliens were involved. And I just have to say that I believe she's wrong about that, that I'm satisfied that she is a legitimate alien abductee with MyLab experiences, and that she was just subjected to a comprehensive mind control program to make her essentially retract all of her previous comments about aliens. But anyway, the point of relevance is that when she was having these encounters with the Palladians, before she retracted, before she's claimed that, you know, she's only had military experiences, long before that, she had these encounters with these Palladians. And the Palladians told her, time is like a slinky. Now, those of you who remember the toy back in the 70s, the slinky toy, it would be this wound coil that could be made to move in steps forwards or backwards. Again, the similarity to what the Zetas told Dan Sherman, that they can go around time. And here's the Palladians saying, time is like a slinky. It kind of goes forwards and backwards, but also the way I infer it to mean, and the way I intuitively feel it to mean, that the coils of the slinky toy also suggest some aspect of this time travel capability of going around, if not through, right? Because the slinky is basically, if you laid it out flat, it would be like a cylinder, just a coil from one end to the other. But it's wound and the tension is such that when you make the slinky, you twist it to the left or twist it to the right, it will start to walk in either direction for a certain period of time. So that's an example of, again, an abductee and a MyLab being told about time. Bill Hamilton, a veteran UFO researcher, himself a contactee, he was a member of the old Giant Rock crowd. He knew George Van Tassel personally. George Van Tassel built the Integutron in the, I think it was in Joshua Tree, somewhere in the desert of Southern California. George Van Tassel was in contact with human-looking ETs. And Bill Hamilton was sky watching near Area 51. I can't remember if he was near the black mailbox, if he was on the Groom Road, exactly where he was. But long story short, he was taken on board a flying saucer by a tall gray while his wife, Pamela, was abducted by these humans wearing SWAT-type black unis with black ball caps and dark wraparound shades, even though it was the middle of the night. There were also little grays involved. And the grays seemed to be afraid of the military, so I can't remember the exact story, the exact details. But the point of relevance is that when Bill was taken on board by the tall gray, it was about a 6 foot tall gray, Bill's heart rate had, you know, understandably went sky high. And the tall gray had laid Bill down, not on a flat horizontal table, but one inclined diagonally. And telepathically, the tall gray told Bill, your heart rate is very high, and we're going to, in so many words, we're going to stabilize your condition. And so as the tall gray was stabilizing Bill's condition, it started telling him things. The tall gray actually started to express misgivings about what the humans were doing at Area 51. He said, do you know that the military is experimenting with time over at the base, i.e. Area 51? Now, I just spoke earlier about how Bob Lazar was part of a team that experimented with a gravity wave amplifier powered up by the element 115, which produced the strong gravity B gravity wave, which could be accessed and amplified. And they grabbed one of the three gravity wave amplifiers beneath, I'm assuming they took it from the sport model that Lazar was working on, and then they powered it up, and they aimed the gravity wave amplifier at a flame, and they froze the flame. Well, then here's this alien telling Bill Hamilton about how the military is experimenting with time over at Area 51, S4, he may not have been referring to the experiment done by Bob Lazar and his team. It seems to me that the experiment that Bob Lazar and his team were conducting is kind of, in the overall scheme of things, kind of like a lower grade kind of experiment. It wasn't by any means in the operational phase. And I intuitively feel that the tall gray, when he was complaining about the military doing time travel experiments at the Area 51 S4 complex, he was referring to experiments that, if not at the operational phase, were already verging on the operational phase. And again, so many of these deep black programs, weird science programs involving aliens, alien technology, interdimensional beings, there are factions of these. They're not all one monolithic block. I believe that some of these groups, projects, factions have more technological capabilities than the others. Although, by surface level standards, they're all very high indeed, right? So keep that in mind, that Bill Hamilton was told by a tall gray that the military is experimenting with time travel over at the Nevada test site. I myself had an experience where I was taken, put through a lot of training, a lot of running. In this scenario, I was running through all these underground caverns and eventually wound up on the surface and was swimming underwater in a canal, and actually at one point had to infiltrate a large mansion. And the story is just too deep and too complex to get into, but the long and the short of it was, when I was returned, I was returned to a point in time before I was abducted, okay? Because that night, I distinctly remember falling asleep after midnight. I had one of those cable boxes on top of my telly that told me the time. And I fell asleep. It was after midnight. And then when I was returned from this experience, it was about 10 p.m., 2 hours before I was abducted. And I don't know if that was done intentionally or if it was a mistake, whatever the case may be. And I'm not entirely convinced that aliens were behind that particular experience either. It's too long and too complex to go into. But I think that it was not an alien abduction in that instance. So that is just a personal example of what I had gone through. Now, the shamanistic perspective is what I'm going to talk about next. But by no means am I suggesting I'm a shaman. Although I've had past lives where I was somewhat shamanistic in nature. But I have had a lifetime of precognitive dreams, i.e. dreaming of the future. And these future events may transpire in exact minute detail as I had previously dreamed them. And the actual event or events in the normal waking 3D consciousness may transpire a week after I dreamed about it, a month after I dreamed about it, a year after I dreamed about it. It varied. And sometimes it would involve people, these precognitive dreams, it would involve people that I had no knowledge of. I would just dream of these people that I never knew before and never heard of going through some kind of an experience. And then, lo and behold, months later, I'm at a party, I'm at some kind of social function, I meet someone new on the job, we get the talking, and out of them comes a story that they had experienced kind of a sequence, chain of events, interesting story, which they relate to me, but which I had previously dreamed long before I knew these people even existed. And of course, there's a variation of that, which involves me dreaming about myself in this, that, or the other scenario. And sometimes these scenarios in these precognitive dreams are so outlandish, so silly, so far-fetched, that even if I remember them in the morning, even if I manage to write them down, they seem so silly and so far-fetched that I don't give it another thought. I just think that's a weird dream. And then weeks, months, or years later, the exact same thing happens to me. And I say, whoa, I dreamed about this. I'm in the midst of a deja vu moment. I'm remembering this. And sometimes as someone is telling me something that they've seen, experienced, or done, I'm having a deja vu moment because in real time, I am remembering a precognitive dream I had, which featured the person relating the story to me having the experiences he's relating to me. But I'm remembering the dreams in real time as he's telling me. So the point I'm making here is that, again, time is not linear. When we sleep, some of us go dimension hopping and some of us tap into a future timeline, a future probability, and see it happening in an immediate first-person sense wherein we view ourselves as going through this experience or a series of experiences in this dream, but not from a third-person perspective where one is looking at oneself having a dream or experience. What I'm talking about sometimes, one is having a dream of having these experiences, of looking out from one's own perspective, interacting with the environment, interacting with people, interacting with things, and then months or years later, lo and behold, we undergo the exact same experience. And I've had many times when I say to myself, wow, I'm having a deja vu moment. I had this exact experience now. I had experienced this before in a precognitive dream. Because, again, when we leave our bodies, some of us have the capability of tapping into a future timeline. again, these are probabilities. Nothing is set in stone. Think of it more as like a thick pea soup with all these different probabilities all mashed in, all mixed in together. And it's not a case of a timeline diverging one way or another. It's just think of it as like a big soup with a lot of ingredients in it. And then depending on the circumstances in any given timeline, any given point in time, certain circumstances pertain, and then out of that comes certain outcomes, and out of that comes the maintenance of a given timeline or the divergence branching off of a certain timeline, if you follow my meaning. Because we humans are multidimensional in nature. I don't know if it was Einstein or somebody, whoever said time is the fourth dimension, well, they were a knucklehead. Because time is the most relative of things. Time does not pass the same. Time does not flow the same from one dimension to another. So to suggest that time, generically, time is the fourth dimension over and above 3D, that is wrong. Because this 3D construct in which we find ourselves in on this planet, it's a linear flat field effect, if you will. It's a facet of the control system that we were stuck in this linear time treadmill, if you will. It's part of the control system that we cannot manifest and experience on a moment-by-moment, day-by-day mode, the ability to escape, if you will, or momentarily get out of this linear 3D flat field time perspective. That is a key facet of this prison planet matrix that we find ourselves in. But I think things are changing. The fundamental constants are changing because those of us who have precognitive dreaming capabilities, what we're noticing is the time lag, the lag between the time we're having these precognitive dreams and the moment in space-time when we're having a deja vu moment and actually in normal 3D waking consciousness going through these experiences that we actually dreamed about, the lag between the precognitive dream and experiencing the actual experience itself is diminishing. And so what some of us are experiencing is we're noticing a deja vu moment for a precognitive dream we had a week ago or 2 weeks ago or several days ago. So the lag time is diminishing. And also we're also seeing in the realm of manifestations, the lag time from the moment we put out a thought, a desire, a wish, an intention, we put out a desire for an answer to a particular question. Well, the response from the divine matrix, as Greg Braden calls it, the response time, again, is diminishing. The lag time from the time we put out the intention, we put out we seek the question, the answer to the question we're putting out, the intention or the vision of what we want to experience or what we want to achieve, well, we're manifesting that in sooner and sooner. It's not taking as long anymore for these answers, for these manifestations to come back to us. That's a very important point to make because some of us are starting to slip beyond the bounds more and more frequently on a more and more frequent basis than we have in the past. And some people are far more advanced than others by dint of their DNA, the fact that they are enhanced hybrid human with two or more extraterrestrial genetic profiles within them and within their energetic morphogenetic field. So people like that, and I know a lot of these people, they're starting to even exceed their own capabilities, which were already considerable to begin with. So I wanted to point that out. Another thing I wanted to talk about is the Mandela effect. The Mandela effect is real. And what I'm going to talk about now is how the Mandela effect has affected me personally. Some of you may have heard me talk about my experience with the Mandela effect. And for those of you that are new to the term, the Mandela effect refers to the fact that the timeline in which you reside has been altered, and that memories of events which we know to have happened in the past, they either never happened or they've been changed either a little bit or have been changed a lot. The Mandela effect term comes from Nelson Mandela, and many people remember Nelson Mandela as having died in prison back in the day. But Nelson Mandela apparently is still very much with us. There's another Mandela effect insofar as Star Wars is concerned. The famous line, "No, Luke, I am your father." And then whatever is changed into in the recent past, that's been a divergence in the timeline. So I'm going to relate to you now what I've experienced. In 1982, the rock and roll band The Who embarked on what was described as their farewell tour. And a lot of us fell for it. We thought The Who would play one more tour and we'd never see them again. So they embarked on the 1982 world tour, mostly North American tour, and they billed it as their farewell tour. And a little backstory, the 1979-1980 tour was somewhat of a disappointment, certainly was for me. I wasn't old enough to see them in their glory days, but I did see a lot of documentaries about them and film, and the one documentary, The Kids Are All Right. And so a lot of us went to the 79-80 tour thinking that we're going to see something similar to what people saw in the latter part of The Kids Are All Right documentary. The Who playing at very loud volume and basically a three-piece band with a vocalist. And we were disappointed. That didn't happen. In the 79-80 tour, Townsend, the lead guitarist and principal songwriter, brought along a horn section, and they didn't play that loud. The volume was very low. The whole tour was, to me, it was a disappointment. And so when 82 rolls around and they build it as their farewell tour, and they said that beforehand, the Townsend said, we're going to knock the fan socks off. Well, that got a lot of us excited. And so Townsend also, along with the rest of The Who, issued a press release or had a press conference, I can't remember which, where they stated that they were not going to play the song My Generation anymore. They were not going to play it on the upcoming farewell tour, because Townsend is an intellectual, but at times he tends to over-intellectualize things, mostly due to his own self-indulgence. And I think that he said something to the effect that the song My Generation, which came out in 65, if memory serves, no longer represented the band, yada, 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 right? Okay, so keep that point in mind. It's important. They announced before the tour that they were not going to play My Generation, one of their signature tunes. What I decided to do when The Who came in October 23rd, 1982, for the outdoor show at the formerly known as the Oakland Alameda County Coliseum, and it's undergone a few name changes since then, and they've reconfigured the stadium. But back then, the way it used to be, when the Oakland Raiders played there originally before it was reconfigured, and the Oakland A's, the baseball team, they would have every summer what was called a day on the green. And that's what they called the big outdoor stadium shows in Oakland, Oakland Stadium. In Southern California, at Anaheim, the Big A, another stadium, they called it Summer Strut, right? And it varied. If you go to Atlanta, they had a name for their outdoor summer, the outdoor festivals with multiple bands. But in Oakland, they were called a day on the green being the big expanse of outfield grass at Oakland Stadium, and also the large amount of foul territory If you're looking at it from a baseball perspective, that typified the Oakland, still typifies the Oakland Stadium. The seating for the Oakland Stadium was about 55,000, and plus all the people crammed onto the field in a general admission concert. So I decided to write down the names of the songs and save it for posterity. And one of the third song they played, they opened up with Substitute. They went into Can't Explain. Daughtry talked to the crowd. They introduced songs from their new album, which they were supporting and touring under, called It's Hard. And the song, the third song they played was, and this is important, this is where the Mandela effect kicks in. The third song they played with was It's Your Turn, a song written by the bass player John Entwistle. Now, another thing about The Who is, and Townsend in particular, is especially in their heyday, you know, early to mid-70s, let's say up to about 75, 76, 77, The Who played incredibly loud. And Townsend would sometimes fall into a pattern where he would just bang out power chords and not play a whole lot of guitar solos. Townsend was very temperamental. Depending on what night you caught him at, what gig you caught him at, he could play a lot of guitar solos or not so many. It just depended. And like in the old days when he was a heavy drinker, sometimes he would play a lot of solos, sometimes not so many. And again, a lot of us were thinking this is their last tour. We're never going to see these guys again. Of course, nowadays, Roger and Pete Townsend are hitting the stage. They're practically geriatrics by now. Roger's voice is gone, right? They might as well run out to the stage with strollers nowadays. Anyway, back in the old days, it was a hit or miss whether Townsend would solo a lot or not. And the crowd was keyed up. It sprinkled and rained lightly the night before. And we were all collectively hoping, putting it out in the vast intentional field, that we did not want to rain out. And so the next morning, October 23rd, the weather cleared up and we had a bright sunny day. The Clash opened up. And then in between The Clash and The Who, they played a lot of music. They played Pink Floyd's Dark Side of the Moon right before The Who took the stage. And then, like I said, they opened up with Substitute, played I Can't Explain. Daughtry talked to the crowd, introduced the new songs, including It's Your Turn. And in that song, Townsend began to solo a lot. And every time Townsend soloed on his guitar, the crowd roared. The crowd roared for however long the solo was, because we were all keyed up. We thought we'd never see these guys again. Silly us. The fourth song was Dangerous, also written by John Entwistle. Fifth song was Sister Disco. Sixth song was Eminence Front. The sixth song was It's Hard. Seventh song was Eminence Front. And those three songs, It's Your Turn, It's Hard, and Eminence Front, were all from the It's Hard album that they were touring on. And then after Eminence Front, they went into the synthesizer intro for Baba O'Reilly, i.e. the Teenage Wasteland song. I jumped out of the seat. I thrust my hands in the air. The piece of paper in which I was writing all these songs went flying through the air, landed a few rows in front of me. And it was several songs before I can get down and retrieve that piece of paper. And by then, it was too dark. I couldn't be bothered with writing the songs down anymore. But I distinctly wrote down, It's Your Turn, because Townsend really started soloing on that song. Now, the indoor show, two nights later, October 25th, 1982, I left school early that morning, me and my buddy, Mark, got to Oakland Coliseum Arena, right next to Oakland Stadium. Got there about a little before noon. The weather report said there was going to be a lot of rain, but it was patchy cloud cover, bits of sunlight coming through. We were near the front of the line. And long story short, we were one of the first ones let in on that side of the arena, and we withstood a torrential downpour for most of the day. And we were let in. T-Bone Burnett opened up, no Clash this time, and then The Who hit the stage after the break between T-Bone Burnett and The Who, and they opened up with My Generation. Oh no, let me backtrack. In the October 23rd, 1982 show, the crowd was so into it. The crowd was roaring so much because we all thought we'd never see these guys again. Remember that. Key point to remember. And Townsend was jamming. He was soloing a lot in the outdoor show. And every time he soloed, the crowd roared. Every time. Every time Townsend windmilled his arms, his patented windmill strumming style, the crowd roared. Every time he did a leap through the air, scissors kick, jump through the air, which was his trademark, the crowd roared. Every time Daughtry swung his microphone around, the crowd was into it. The crowd was so into it, at one point, Townsend said, "You're all making us feel at home in a big place like this." And the Oakland Stadium is a cavernous ballpark. One of the nicknames it had in the old days in baseball circles was the Oakland Mausoleum, because it was such a big ballpark with heavy night air that you just didn't score many runs there. That's why it was called the Oakland Mausoleum, because it was so big. But anyway, Townsend said, "You're making us feel at home here." And then about two-thirds of the way through the first set, a complete surprise, The Who launched into My Generation, and the crowd went nuts. I got up out of my seat, started boogieing, started dancing. After that song, the crowd gave the loudest roar I ever heard. And remember, Townsend said they were not going to play My Generation during the entire tour. And here they were. They play it two-thirds of the way through the first set. And I can tell you all this because I have a good memory. It's a Scorpio thing. A lot of Scorpios have good memories. I used to have a really great memory in the old days, but, you know, over time, my memory isn't what it used to be, but I still remember this gig. Okay, back to the October 25th indoor arena show. Soaking wet, because I withstood a torrential downpour all day long in line. And finally, The Who hit the stage. They open up with My Generation. I guess it was a reward for the fans for being so loud and appreciative to them. Because typically, folks, a big outdoor stadium show, really, most of the crowd noise is generated by the people in front of the stage, the people on the field, not so much from the people in the seats. But at the outdoor Oakland Stadium show, October 23rd, 1982, the whole stadium roared after every song. I could literally intuit an energy field coming from the crowd hammering the stage of energy, of yelling, screaming. And so as a reward for that, two days later, the indoor evening show, The Who opened with My Generation. Remember, they said they were not going to play that song through the whole tour. Played My Generation, went in, I Can't Explain. Daughtry talked to the crowd. They played It's Your Turn Again. And then they played Sister Disco after that, and then they played a few other songs, played the rest of the set. Okay. And I'll also tell you what The Who was wearing on the second night. I remember what they were wearing on the outdoor show, but it doesn't bear relevance to our story. Only insofar as I remember what they were wearing in the first show. Now, in the second show, Daughtry came out wearing a white sport jacket with white pants. He had dark pants, and he had a white T-shirt with black stripes. Later on, he took off the white sport coat, and underneath was a gray long sleeve jacket. Townsend was wearing a leather jacket. He had a blue short sleeve shirt underneath, and he had a red and white checkered pair of pants and blue shoes. Think of the old Kenner shoes in the old days, if I remember the brand name correctly. John Entwistle was wearing a three-piece suit, a gray three-piece suit, and he had his big arachnid pendant right prominently displayed on his chest. I was in the fourth row on the right-hand side, and I had a pair of binoculars too, so I could see very well. And we stood up the whole concert. So here's where the Mandela effect kicks in. Years and years and years later, YouTube pops up, and all these people start posting all these bootleg concerts. You can see here lots of bootleg Zeppelin, for example. Anyway, and all these people start posting these concerts from the 1982 Who tour. In the two recordings that are posted on YouTube, which purport to be the two shows I went to, October 23rd, the outdoor stadium show, October 25th, the indoor arena show, and the YouTubers posted the set list, the song list for both concerts. The song "It's Your Turn" was not listed or played in those recordings. Not only that, though, but the crowd didn't even sound the same. You can hear people talking during the recording in between songs. It was too loud to talk during the show because the Who went back to their old volume for their so-called farewell tour, their old loud volume. But after the end of each song, I did not hear the loud roar that came from the Oakland Stadium outdoor crowd on October 23rd, 82. Ditto, the indoor show, October 25th, 82, was one long continuous roar. There was no, like, silence or gaps in sound in between the songs and the indoor show. What I mean by that is, like, okay, you can hear the crowd roars and then he settled down, then another song kicks in. No, it was the moment the Who finished playing a song in the indoor show, it was a continuous roar until, you know, part of the way into the next song, because we were all appreciative. We were showing them our appreciation for all the great music and performances they played over the years. We thought we'd never see them again. So when I listened to the audio of these bootlegs, not only is the song "It's Your Turn" not on there, and it's not even listed in the set list, but the crowd doesn't even sound the same. And at first I thought, well, maybe someone just mislabeled the gigs. Maybe it's really a show in some other part of the U.S., and it's not really the Oakland shows. But then more than one person posted the audio from those two dates. And the thing about it was, in the outdoor show, I distinctly remembered My Generation being played two-thirds of the way through. And the indoor show, My Generation was played as the opener. Now, here's where it really gets weird. Not only is It's Your Turn not on the two recordings for the two Oakland shows, but according to some comments by people who were listening to these Who bootleg recordings, It's Your Turn was never played throughout the whole tour. And get this. When I play the concerts from the shows before the two Oakland gigs in Seattle and in some other places, they opened up with My Generation. Okay? Remember, the Who said they were not going to play My Generation on the entire tour. They surprised everyone by playing it two-thirds of the way through the Oakland outdoor stadium show because the crowd was so into it. And then now, years later, I come to find out all these recordings prior to when I saw them where The Who was opening up with My Generation. Now, I distinctly remember, after our gigs in Oakland, they started opening up some of the shows with My Generation, right? Here's another thing where the Mandela effect kicks in. There's a video out there which purports to show The Who playing Long Live Rock from their Odds and Sods album. And it was listed as the indoor Oakland show, October 25th, 1982. But that was not song that I saw them play. They were not even dressed the same way. I told you a little while ago what the Who was dressed like in the October 25th, 1982 show, in which I was soaking wet from having stood outside in the rain all day. The Who were dressed completely different in this video, and the video purported to be from October 25th, 1982 in Oakland. Not only that, they didn't even play the same version of Long Live Rock. I distinctly remember a different version of Long Live Rock. So the reason I'm belaboring all this was It's Your Turn was supposedly in the new Alter timeline, never played throughout the whole tour, but I remember the crowd was roaring in the outdoor show because Townsend was soloing. He was in a solo mood that day. Didn't jam so much in the indoor show, but he jammed a lot in the outdoor show. And they played It's Your Turn in the indoor show. They opened up with My Generation on the indoor show. They played My Generation about two-thirds of the way through the outdoor show two days before. All that has been whitewashed. All that has changed. Now, in the shows leading up to Oakland, they're on YouTube. They're already opening with My Generation. And they're saying they never played It's Your Turn. And then on the October 25th recording video on YouTube purporting to show them play Long Live Rock in the Oakland Coliseum Arena, they weren't even dressed the same, okay? So that's what I mean by the Mandela effect. Something happened that changed and altered history radically. But because I'm a Who fan, I remember these things. And also another factor, too. And again, I want to emphasize this. In the recordings of October 23rd, 25th, 82 that you find on YouTube, it's not the same crowd. The crowd was roaring. We were going crazy. We thought we'd never see these guys again. But when you listen to these crowds, they're almost passive. I mean, there's silence after some of the songs, practically. You can practically hear crickets chirping. That was not us. There were people calling up the radio stations in the Bay Area after the Monday night, October 25th indoor show, and the first thing they talked about was the energy of the crowd, how much they were roaring, how much they were screaming. And that's all that's changed now. So the Mandela effect and how I've experienced it firsthand and how I remember it, because it affected me deeply as a Who fan. It spun me out for a while, to be honest with you. Anyway, we've reached the end of the first segment of Bartley's commentaries on the cosmic wars. I've just finished talking about time, local time manipulation, macro time manipulation, alternate timelines, the Mandela effect. In the second hour, I will talk about aspects of the reptilian hybridization process and how the people that wind up intentionally becoming raging, hate-filled, violent, sadistic, even serial murderer type reptilian hybrids, Draco hybrids, how they wind up that way and why there are more and more of them today. So we'll catch you at the top of the next hour. Thank you.